This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The demand for food is expected to double in the next 20 years. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, the need for a new green revolution. Richard Manning examines how we might feed ourselves in the years to come in his new book, Food's Frontier, The Next Green Revolution. Manning says a new green revolution is likely to spring from the developing world. He says indigenous knowledge and native crops will be one key to meeting the demand for food in the 21st century. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, Richard Manning. Join the discussion with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Richard Manning is also the author of Last Stand, A Good House, Grassland, and One Round River. His new book, Food's Frontier, is published by North Point Press, a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Richard Manning, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thank you.
Sure. To begin with, I would like you to tell us about the McKnight Foundation and how you came to write this book.
Sure. The McKnight Foundation is based in Minneapolis. It's old 3M money, essentially. And the family that was responsible for 3M set up a foundation that now includes family members, and they're into a number of philanthropic projects all over the world. But developing world agriculture happens to be one of those. Over the years, it evolved within the organization that they wanted to do research, scientific research in developing world agriculture, specifically in crops. And so they did a first round, and the program evolved. Till now, it's run by a group of 11 scientists from around the world. And that's to keep it independent, as well as to make sure that the projects include absolutely the best science. I came onto the project. They asked me to go look at 9 of their projects that they had funded. And the idea was for the book was one of the scientists on the board who essentially said that, you know, if you look at these 9 projects, you have almost a mosaic picture of what agriculture is going to look like in the next century. So we thought it would make an interesting project, and it did it.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult then to get North Point to sign up with us?
No, not at all. They were happy to have the book. And one of the things I did with McKnight up front was ask for and got editorial independence on the project. So it then started to look very much like a book. And we also guarantee that independence by having the oversight committee, the group of scientists, to kind of mediate between the foundation and me. And it didn't take much mediation. So North Point was very happy to sign on it. It's right in the line of the kind of thing they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did it.
Okay. Is it really expected that the demand for food will double by 2020?
More or less. And there are a couple things driving that. One is population growth that we're expecting. And we have to remember, we did double the world's population in the last 30 years. We went from 3 billion to 6 billion people in my lifetime, certainly much less than my lifetime. So it's not a great stretch to think we'll double in the next 20. The other thing that's driving that is development, economic development in places like China, especially China, where the income is rising. And as incomes rise, people tend to eat more meat. When they eat more meat, it demands a lot more grain. It takes something like 10 times the amount of grain to produce a calorie of food through meat than it does through grain. So those two things together will probably double the demand for food.
Hmm. Now, over the last 30, 40 years, there were great gains in grain yields.
Absolutely.
What led to those gains? What fueled the Green Revolution?
Well, the Green Revolution itself was actually in two crops, in wheat and rice. And it was largely fueled by the work of Norman Borlaug, and working in Mexico originally on some breeding projects. He found ways to make, and it's very simple actually, he made both wheat and rice shorter. Now that sounds like not such a big deal at all. But it turns out that the architecture of a plant is very important. And when you make it shorter, it can put much more energy into seed as opposed to stem. Not only that, the shorter stems will support a heavier seed head. So though you can feed it a lot more fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizers, and in effect triple yield. Now, that was added to something that actually took place before Borlaug started to work, and that people in the Midwest are very familiar with, which was hybrid corn. So as a result of the work done in the Midwest in the 30s and 40s, corn yields also tripled around the world and became a very important crop. So as a consequence of the Green Revolution, we now have almost 60% of the world's food coming from three crops, rice, wheat, and corn.
The rate of increase in yields, though, has now dropped back.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, we're reaching the limits of the technology. There's only so much blood in the turnip here as you can get out of it. And the technology itself depends on something called a harvest index. In other words, so if you take the weight of a total plant and take off what is the proportion of that is food, the seed, in other words, in this case, then there's a theoretical maximum of about 60%. Once you get to 60%, you still got to have some stem, some leaf, some root, and you have to use the energy for those things. And we're about there. So there's really not much more to be gained in these sorts of technologies. We know that. By the same token, we have to recognize that these technologies have been enormously damaging to the environment. The nitrogen loading that we see in the Midwest that is now going down the Mississippi and creating the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is a direct result of the kinds of things we did with nitrogen fertilizers. So it's kind of a double whammy on the whole problem. First of all, we reached the limit of current technologies, but we also know that those technologies are not sustainable. So we got to look at another area.
Yeah, one of the people you met writing this book, Timothy Reeves, he wondered aloud to you, in feeding ourselves, are we starving our descendants?
That's right. That's right. Timothy Reeves is a very thoughtful man. He's an Australian, and he runs CIMMYT. He's the director general of CIMMYT, which is the world's leading institution for research on corn and wheat. And it, in fact, was the foundation of the Green Revolution. That's where it started. Norman Borlaug still works there to this day. And so if the people responsible for the Green Revolution are wondering about their technologies, it's no wonder that the rest of the world has to wonder as well.
Yeah. A really important point you make early in the book, securing a food supply rests on more than just boosting yield. Talk with us about that idea. Explain that.
Well, yes. In the United States, it's a very good example, where we have been enormously successful at boosting yields, and yet at the same time, our farmers are they're in a deficit situation. So we spent in this country $28 billion on direct payments to farmers. Federal payments, farm subsidies, last year, because that yield itself has suppressed prices. In the developing world, what that means is often we export our grain to them or give it to them, and as a consequence, the farmers in the developing world go broke. Essentially, they don't have those protections of subsidies. So our high yields here often can torpedo farming around the world and that kind of development that's necessary in the developing world.
How might a new green revolution differ from the first?
Well, one of the things I think we have to do is pay attention to this question of yield that you just brought up. It's very important because in the initial green revolution, we thought about yield and nothing else almost. We didn't think about the impacts on communities of increasing that yield. And the problem is not that we don't grow enough food in the world. We have to be very conscious of that. The problem is that we have so many poor people who can't afford to buy it. We have roughly 1.3 billion people in the world, something like that, between 1.3 and 1.6 billion. That's almost a third of the world's population, that lives on less than a dollar a day, $365 a year. Those people can't afford grain. They can't afford it at any price. So the problem is not producing more food. Yes, we have famines in the world, but those are almost always a direct result of political instability. The problem is to get these people enough income so they can afford to buy food or raise their own. Now, that has a lot to do with agriculture still, because in the developing world, the first rung or the first step toward development is generally agriculture. So what we do have to do is pay attention to developing agriculture within those poorest communities.
In a chapter devoted to Uganda, you write, it's been said that there are three stages of agriculture, and only the last is sustainable.
That's right.
What are the three stages? Where are we today?
Well, that's an interesting point, and it gets to the fundamental problem of agriculture, and that agriculture is a very simple system in one sense. We're doing it almost the same as we did it 10,000 years ago. And we developed agriculture 10,000 years, we being the human race. We did it in conjunction with catastrophe. We did it by burning, or we did it in flood areas, where natural catastrophes had wiped out all the plant life. And we developed plants there that are colonizing species. They're the kind of species that move in when a system has been destroyed. All our grasses are that way, and that's what we eat. We eat grass. Wheat, rice, corn are all grasses. What that means is been agriculture essentially has been a fight against nature from the very beginning, because nature wants to go in the opposite direction. Now, that gets back to the levels of solutions. Our first level of solution is what I'll call input. In other words, if we have a problem, we're not getting enough yield, then we adjust that by input, by putting on more fertilizer, one of the inputs, one of the things we add on. If pests are attacking our plants, then we adjust that by pesticides, putting more on. And that level of solution creates another range of problems, like the pollution from the nitrogen or the pollution from the pesticides. So we go to the second level, and we're very much in that phase in the United States right now, which I'll call substitution. And that is that if your input is creating a problem, you simply find a new input. So if pesticides are creating a problem, then you go to BT. You spray the organic pesticide instead of a chemical pesticide, and that's less damaging to the environment. You figure out ways to substitute for nitrogen fertilizers or to manage it. And that's an interesting level. That's where we are. And it will certainly solve some problems, but it won't solve the fundamental problem that agriculture is still a simplified ecological system. And if we go to the third level, and that's we're just beginning to get there, although there are some places in the developing world where they understand this quite well, then we stop working against nature and start letting nature do some of the work for us. And that's not nearly as theoretical or as new agey as it sounds at all. What that is doing is relying on something I'll call ecosystem services. So to control your predators or insects, you have predators around who actually eat them. We've done for years. You don't plant a single crop. You plant many crops together at the same time, so they start to look more like a prairie than they look like a farmer's field now. And those ecosystem services start to take care of the work for us.
Hmm. Uganda and sweet potatoes, very interesting way of doing just that, getting to work with Mother Nature rather than against her.
Yes.
Now, tell us the story about Uganda and how farmers are learning to cultivate sweet potatoes so they get more of their crop.
Yeah, Uganda is a very interesting case because they've had so much political instability there, and that's really the cause of these problems. So we all remember Idi Amin, and he was, of course, the ruler of Uganda years ago, and it ended up massacring a lot of people, so that people are very used to violence. But they're in an era of peace now. They have a fairly a competent government, and they're doing solid agricultural research based on their own needs within the country as opposed to export needs, which is all really positive steps, all of those. Sweet potatoes are probably, if you go in that region of Africa, there are probably eight nations in that region, and in each of those eight nations, sweet potatoes would rank either first, second, or third as the leading source of food. The other two would be bananas and cassava. They're all really important to subsistence agriculture. And by that, I mean the kind of plots that have maybe an acre of land and a family, usually a woman alone on the family, living in a mud hut with four or five children trying to feed her family. It's simple as that. Sweet potatoes are not indigenous to Africa, but they were transplanted there from South America. And they have all sorts of unique problems in Africa, both from viruses and from bugs. There's a weevil that attacks them, and it actually destroys a lot of the crop. And in the tropics, you can imagine what it's like to try to control insects. I mean, it's bad enough in the Midwest, but in the tropics, it's unbelievably bad, and it's the same with virus problems. So they're doing all sorts of novel systems within Uganda's setting. They're using integrated pest management in ways that, and sometimes that's more sophisticated than what I've seen in the United States. They're using pheromones to trap the insects. They're studying ways to harvest the sweet potatoes earlier so the sweet potatoes aren't attacked by the insects. In other words, they're relying on a number of locally derived sources of solutions, which I think is just absolutely vital to the kind of solutions we need to see around the world.
Hmm. Now I'd like you to tell us the story of Ethiopia that you tell in the book. Fascinating, another fascinating place, another fascinating crop called teff.
That's right.
T-E-F.
That's right.
What is it?
Teff is a fascinating little crop, as you said. It's a grain, but it's pretty. It's very fine grain with very fine seed head, and it has literally thousands of seeds on a single head. So when it's ripening, it's actually quite pretty. It is the leading source of food in Ethiopia, and probably no people here have never heard of it. Maybe you've heard, if you've eaten in an Ethiopian restaurant, you've eating a sour bread called injera. And injera is actually made from teff. But if you talk to an Ethiopian, they'll say, you know, I really don't feel like I've eaten today unless I've eaten teff. They eat teff every day. They tend to eat it three times a day, and this happens in the developing world often. And it's the only place in the world that this happens. Well, it turns out that it's actually a very good crop for Ethiopia. It's well adapted to their situation, and yes, there are crop failures, but the farmers there told me that it doesn't matter how bad it gets, they almost always get some harvest. So in subsistence agriculture, they at least have enough to feed their families if they don't have enough to sell surplus. It has an interesting sort of problem, though, in that it's lodging, and farmers in the Midwest are familiar with lodging. It's when a storm comes along or a rainstorm, and it tips your whole crop over. And so if you're a wheat farmer, all your seed heads end up in the mud, and you lose a great deal of your crop because it simply tips over. Teff is enormously susceptible to that, and they will lose, on average, 20, 30, 40% of their crop every year to lodging. So if you could solve this one simple little problem, you would give that country food security just like that. That's all it takes. And because they grow so much of it. And so they're doing so with conventional plant breeding. And they're trying to get, they've gathered all the examples of teff they can find from all over the country, and they're doing this very involved breeding program trying to do almost exactly what Norman Borlaug did. Tried to make short plants, short teff, to feed their nation. It's going to be difficult because there's not a lot of variation in teff. There aren't dwarfing genes to make it small. So I think, and they didn't tell me this, but I think what's going to eventually happen is they'll end up doing some genetic engineering.
Hmm. Well, you brought up the topic.
Yep.
What are your thoughts about genetic engineering? You note in the book that they've changed over the course of your work on this project.
Yeah, they absolutely have, and because I see the value of it. And the teff is a very good example of that. It's an island population, and so it doesn't have what we would call a polymorphism. What that means is there's not a lot of variation in the population. So in other words, if they would rely on conventional plant breeding to get the genes they're after, they're going to look a very long time. But those genes exist already in wheat and in rice. We know that. We've used dwarfing genes across there. The genomes are very similar because the plants are very closely related, and they wouldn't breed together normally, but you could imagine a situation where they pull that dwarfing gene off. Now, how dangerous is that? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's dangerous at all in this case. And mind you, I think there are cases where of genetic engineering where I'm bothered by it. But this looks so much like conventional plant breeding, and the potential benefits from it are so great for a country like Ethiopia that I think it's worth doing. And especially because they tried first through conventional plant breeding, and they've been unable to solve it so far.
I want to go back to Ethiopia in a moment, but I want to flash forward now to the pod borer. And genetic engineering in that case might not be such a good idea.
Well, you know, in that case, I'd even tend to support that one, but you're right. It does go closer to the line. But the pod borer is a very interesting case because it's in India. And India is one of the two countries in the world that we must pay very close attention to. The other one is China. So between those two countries, we have something like 20% of the world's population. Not only that, India is growing very rapidly. No, I'm not sorry. It's more than 20%. It's 30% of the world's population. And India is growing very rapidly, whereas China has got its birth rate under control. India is also developing very rapidly. So back to what I said about incomes, as incomes rise, Indians will eat more meat. But Indians tend to be vegetarian. They don't value meat the way the Chinese do, for instance. This gets back to the story of the pod boar. Because they're vegetarians, they have to get their protein source from plants. And the pod boar attacks chickpeas, which we call garbanzo beans, the same plant. And it's an enormously important source of protein for the Indian diet. If they lose it out of their diet, or if they lose because of crop failure is a high proportion of it, they will either be protein deficient or they'll have to rely on other sources like meat. Now, it also meshes directly with the Green Revolution. Because of Green Revolution research, we enormously boosted yields of grains. So Indians now, and I grew up thinking of India as kind of the poster child of developing world hunger, India feeds itself. And it actually exports some grain because of huge increases in grain. But that very research that drove those increases ignored what we'll call orphan crops or forgotten crops. One of those is chickpeas. As a consequence, Indians had enough protein from chickpeas 30 years ago. That has been cut in half, largely because of population growth, but because other crops have pushed chickpeas off the field. That's kind of a long way of setting up the background of this, which is that this protein is very important to them, and it's been cut in half. Now, the reason it's been cut in half is because of the pod borer. And this is an insect that, as the chickpeas are ripening, goes inside of the pod and simply eats the peas inside. Good trick, right, if you're an insect. And so the farmers will go into their fields at harvest time. They'll start to pick their chickpea crop. And here are these big, fat pods, and they think they're going to feed their children well this year. And they start harvesting and opening the pods, and they find them hollow. You can imagine what that's like. And it's devastating, including some farmers commit suicide every year when this happens. And the Indians told me that, and it was quite an amazing thing. The Indian scientist working on this, and I was told this story by three middle-aged women in saris, and they're all PhDs, all molecular biologists. And they said that they had tried all the usual methods to confer some resistance to the pod borer in the chickpea. They couldn't find it. So they finally found out that there was some native resistance in an Asian wing bean, which is another food crop they eat, and in peanuts. They call them groundnuts. So what they're doing is transferring a gene from the wing bean to the chickpea, and they're making a chickpea that's completely resistant to the pod borer. Now, the alternative to that is to spray insecticides. And Indians don't like insecticides. They can't afford them. And the environment doesn't like insecticides. So if faced with that choice of, first of all, keeping protein in Indians' diet, and second of all, displacing insecticides, I have a hard time seeing the downside of that one.
Well, that pod borer, he's going to think of another way to get around that gene, isn't he?
He absolutely is going to, and in fact has done so five times in the past. The pod borer, the resistance is coming from something called a protease inhibitor, which you probably heard of in conjunction with the AIDS, like the fight against AIDS. And in fact, plants secrete that, and it's one of their natural defenses against bugs. When they got to looking very closely in the chickpeas, they found five of these protease inhibitors, and they couldn't understand why the pod borer was still getting through. So then they looked at the pod borer's stomach, and they found five enzymes for digesting specific protease inhibitors. What that says is there's this arms race that's been going on in evolutionary time between the pod borer and the chickpea. And five times in history, unassisted by humans, just on the way evolution works, this arms race is ratcheted up. And you are exactly correct, it will ratchet up again. That's always the problem with substitutions, getting back to our levels of solution. And it's kind of the Red Queen's problem in Lewis Carroll's Red Queen and Alice in Wonderland. You have to do all the running you can just to stay in place. So, yeah, it's not a long-term solution, and that's why I prefer some other solutions that I saw out there more than this one. But it's a step, and in doing the science to understand, taking a step, they really set themselves up to take the next step just as well.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Richard Manning, we're talking with him about his new book, Food's Frontier, the Next Green Revolution. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Howdy.
Hi.
About the population you were talking about, I just did some research on that and thought you might be interested.
He had originally said that India and China together had about 20% of the world's population, mm-hmm. and then you up that to 30.
Yeah.
And actually, it's closer to 50 than to 30.
Closer to 50?
Yeah.
See, I've got it at 2 billion.
Huh?
I've got it at just over 2 billion.
Well, India's got now over a billion all by itself.
Right.
And China's had over a billion for quite a while.
Right.
And also, depending on different border disputes, you have to account,
right.
you know, as to...
Yeah.
what territory you're counting in this census that you did count last census and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely over 40.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not
in that range.
20 or 30. It's over. If you put your hand over them on a globe, then that in the surrounding territory is half the whole world.
That's right. And most of the growth in the world is in Asia, and especially in what they call megacities, which are cities of over 10 million people, if you can
yeah.
imagine that.
And
I talked to one man on this project who was born in Hyderabad, India, and he's my age. He's a middle-aged man, so it's, you know, less than 40, 50 years. When he was born in Hyderabad, there were 300,000 people there. That's probably close to the size of Champaign, Urbana, isn't it?
Oh, we're only 100,000.
Oh, only 100,000. Well, so, imagine that. You know, you can think of a 300,000 city around there.
Yeah, try that, Peoria.
Hyderabad is now 10 million people. So it went from 300,000 to 10 million in a single lifetime.
In one lifetime. Everybody must have come in from the outlying areas.
Yeah. And that's yeah. part of the result of Green Revolution technology.
Sounds like Mexico City.
Yes, very much like Mexico yeah. City.
Well, thanks
as the
very
farmers
much.
Become more efficient, they do exactly what they did in the United States, which is displace people from the countryside. And they have no place left to go but the shanty towns in the cities.
Hmm. Which is something that you talk about in the book, you write about in the book, and you
yeah.
You mentioned Woody Guthrie
yeah.
and you know how he talked about folks getting tractored off.
Yep, got tractored out by the cats. Remember that line from that song? And it did. It happened in the United States. It began happening almost as soon as we settled the American West. I mean, and I live in Montana, and Montana peaked in population in most of its eastern counties right around 1900. And it's a familiar story throughout the Midwest. And as farming people, we went from roughly half of our people living in rural areas to less than 1% now, or less than 1% on farms, I should say. And if we do that in the developing world, what would the developing world look like if you take those 1.2 billion people in China and move them all into cities out of the countryside? How will those cities possibly function? How will they work?
How are people thinking about that problem?
Well, they think about the Chinese, oddly enough, are taking it on very directly. The Chinese have now contracted with an American firm to design from the ground up a series of small cities. And they would be about in the range of 100,000 to 300,000, what we think of about as a manageable city. And they're very conscious about integrating these cities within the countryside. So in other words, they will have a rural market area, and the farmers around will grow vegetables and sell them in farmers markets within those cities. So there'll be a tie, that rural urban tie, to make things work. That's the best example of people being very conscious about that and trying to deal with the problem. But it's a huge exception to the rule. The rule is they're mostly not dealing with the problem. It's just happening.
Let's talk with another listener, this one on line 4 in Charleston, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask your guest if he has heard of Gaviota. It is a project to reinvent a devastated country, or not the entire country, but Colombian area. Do you know about Gaviotas?
Gaviotas, I do indeed.
Okay.
Yes, I think it's a very interesting project. It was a bunch of city people from Bogota, as I recall, and some people with the university doing research, and they went into the countryside.
Right.
In an area that was really, it was kind of a llano, a plain.
Right.
In the Andes, and essentially built a city from the ground up. And try to use all sorts of sustainable technologies in doing it.
Exactly, including
yes.
food. And they right. included in their research local peoples of all sorts of abilities, from
right.
scientists, technicians, indigenous peoples, everyone. And it is a story that, thanks to Alan Weissman, a reporter mm-hmm. from this country,
yes.
Is known. I hope that more people become acquainted with it, because it is a story that, unlike the rest of the stories from Colombia, is a very redeeming story.
Absolutely. And you've hit on a very important point as well, which is the power of story. And in other words, a lot of these solutions will evolve locally in very local stories. And so what some of us in this whole movement are trying to do now is create a network for sharing these stories.
Mm-hmm.
So when a local solution arises, like gabiosis, or like some of the ones I saw in this, we'll have a way, maybe through the Internet, or maybe a way of communicating those around the world so people can look at them and say, no, I don't want to do this exactly because it's not appropriate to my situation, but here's some ideas. Here's some things we can do.
Exactly. And another thing that I wanted to commend you for is the use of the word developing countries, you know, these third world countries, places, the developing countries into the despicable caste.
Mm-hmm.
That bothers those who come from those countries.
Sure.
And and absolutely, there is nothing stagnant. Perhaps there is too much movement, maybe in the wrong way at times. But
that's right. Yeah, no, and that's, you know, but that creates some problems with it. In the case of China, it's very clear about that. They call themselves a developing country, but they claim without a right to develop the same way the United States did, and while it's really hard to imagine denying them that right, the globe can't afford people to make our mistakes in the next generation.
Exactly.
You know, they can't use the carbon power that we use. They just can't do it,
well,
the fossil fuel stuff. So it's really important to think in those terms of alternative paths to development. I was just in Ireland this past week,
mm-hmm.
and Ireland's a wonderful case. And here's a case that was the basket case of the world. Or not of the world, but of Europe, certainly. It's been a poor country forever. That's why there are so many Irish immigrants in the United States. It is today the fastest-growing economy in the world. The people are prosperous, and they're doing it on a separate path to, say, England or France. They're doing through information technologies and things that are not nearly as polluting, and it's very interesting to see the results of that in a country being quite positive.
Well, thank you for your call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a listener who's waiting for us on line one in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Maybe you recognize the symbol CSM. Do you know if that's still around or what the status is? Or do you want me to tell you what it is?
What was the symbol?
CSM. See, that's corn, soy, milk.
I don't recognize that.
You don't recognize
that? No, and I know about it basically, but I've never heard it referred to that way.
Well, see, a few years ago, that was a very, well, in the times of surpluses,
mm-hmm.
what they did, they combined corn, soy, and milk because they kind of gave a balanced nutrient.
Yes.
And it was distributed, but you haven't heard of it recently.
I've heard of it being distributed around some famines and things like that, yes. It's kind of a great hope in the developing, in some people who deal with famines.
Yeah, well, let's go on to something else.
Sure.
When you spoke about teff, about it was a fine seed.
Yeah.
Well, then, I've seen a fine seed that was called amaranth. Are
yes.
you familiar with amaranth?
Yes, very much.
Is it similar to teff?
No, it's very different. Amaranth is indigenous to Mexico.
Yeah.
It grew up around Mexico City, and they also grow it heavily in Peru, and they relied on it for grain in Peru.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's a very fine seed, but they also eat the leaves. So the greens are important as well. It's a really interesting plant. I grow it in my own garden sometimes because it's pretty. But teff is strictly a grain, and they're not closely related at all, but the use is similar within the cultures.
Oh.
There's an interesting story about amaranth. It was red, and still is red, obviously. And when the Spaniards first discovered it in Mexico City when they conquered that area, they outlawed the growing of it because they thought it violated some religious practice because it was red. It was blood of Christ problem right there. So they outlawed that crop, and therefore we lost many years of development of that crop.
Interesting story. Let's talk with another listener, this one on line two in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
I had something else, but that is an interesting anecdote, and I think the Spaniards thought that amaranth was involved in the native religion, and it probably was in some way, but it was also extremely high protein, so we have centuries of undernourishment, I guess, to credit for that, too.
That's right.
Curious story.
That's exactly right.
I think I have great difference with you on the biotech. I really think that it shouldn't be done as cavalierly without spending a lot more time and energy and research on what unintended consequences could be. But what I wanted to get you to react to is I've just been looking for this news report, and I can't quite find it, but on the BBC this morning, they announced that Havana and Cuba have been picked as a success. I don't know actually if it's Food and Development that have, but for their organic and widespread urban gardening projects. We've just heard this thing about the Colombian experiment. Well, there's an extremely widespread experiment in Cuba, and it's chronicled by Food First, which is I can't remember the what it stands for, but on the web it's foodfirst.org, and it has quite a bit on this agricultural experiment. It's partially a necessity because of the political changes, but I don't know if you've looked into what can be learned from Cuba.
I've heard an awful lot about that as I've gone in the developing world, but not looked at it directly. And you're exactly right that the organic farming there is really quite exemplary. And it's out of necessity because of the embargoes. They can't import things like pesticides. They can't get chemical fertilizers, so they had to deal with it in another way. And the other thing about Cuba that's quite interesting is they have a reputation around the world as being quite expert gene jocks. And that's kind of the colloquial term for people who do biotechnology.
I have mixed feelings about that. They have a huge institute. In fact, they spent $1 billion. And putting up, and we have an emeritus professor in food and agriculture here who goes down quite a bit and says that this gene jock place is quite well equipped and they're doing great stuff. And I hope maybe because they're not just looking at the short-term bottom line, they might actually do that perhaps a little better too.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. And I also think that there are areas in genomics that will mesh very nicely with organic gardening. And I know of a place, and this is not genetic engineering, mind you. This is genomics where they're using the genes to identify and see how the ecosystem works. And I know of an experiment that's going on in Madison, Wisconsin right now between an organic farmer and a biotech group. And they're not doing genetic engineering, but he's finding out what they're doing, tracing microbes. And they're finding microbes in the soil confer disease resistance to the plants just by being able to identify them by their gene profiles.
Yeah, is this through lysogy that they transfer the genetic
material?
Don't know.
It's just we know they're present. They also have found, and the kinds of microbes they're talking about are the archaeal bacteria, which we can't culture. We can only find them by looking for their genetic profile and doing genetic markers on them. And they're finding out, one of the things they found out is that these archaeal bacteria are everywhere in organically farmed soil, but nowhere in industrial farms.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's been asserted that the health of the soil is the first thing
that's
one looks at, and that we're really industrial agricultural as advocated perhaps by many universities and extension programs is actually mining the soil, whereas organic patterns are more looking at the health of the soil and increasing those possibilities.
I think it's an intriguing irony that biotech is providing the window into that traditional knowledge.
Interesting. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're coming down here on the last couple minutes that we'll be able to spend together today with Richard Manning. We could probably get in one more call, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to go back to Ethiopia and a very interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
You report that the problem with understanding TEF and increasing yields unveils another problem. And this was so interesting. This comes through over and over and over again in your book. In this situation, there is a link that is quite weak between us in the developed world and our science and the needs of the developing world. There's an academic catch-22. At work. Here in the U.S., who, for example, wants to study TEF?
That's right.
And in Ethiopia, if opportunity presents itself, people are going to stop studying TEF.
That's right. It's enormously difficult to deal with. And you put it well because it has those two dynamics to it. In other words, if you are a U.S. scientist, why would you invest your career on something that will never pay off? TEF will never make a profit any place along the line, when if you know corn, for instance, from one end to the other, Pioneer Hybrid Seed will hire you for six figures. Right?
Mm.
That's the problem in the U.S., and why stake your career, why you do you even do your Ph.D. on it? Because Ph.D. is really the basis of the rest of your research for the rest of your life. The opposite problem in Ethiopia is when you train someone to the level of Ph.D., and most of their training will come in, well, the scientist that I dealt with there was trained in his Ph.D. in the U.K., and he did his postdoctoral work in Texas. Now, he goes back to his country, he makes $200 a month. And that's not a lot of money in Ethiopia, despite what you might think. He said he can only afford a bicycle, he can't afford a television set, and he can't afford his own apartment. He's a Ph.D. plant breeder. In fact, he's a postdoc. He would easily make six figures in the U.S. And instead, he lives in all that poverty and trying to do something good for his country. Now, you think about that, you think, well, that can't go on for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It won't. It won't. He'll at some point say, you know, I got to do better than this, and he'll try to do better. So it leads to the problem we call brain drain, and it's a very complicated problem, and the foundations are now starting to deal with it pretty directly and pretty effectively, but nonetheless, it's a nasty one.
Yeah. Let's get one more listener in here this afternoon. On line one in Urbana, good afternoon.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I was just curious if your guest had anything to say about how the patent rights are affecting this whole area, because it seems that many new products are being developed not because they're helpful in any particular way, but because they're patentable and therefore profitable. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It's a hard one to get at in a very short comment, but it rears its head in a couple of ways. First of all, one of the things that happens is that the developing world is left pretty much alone because they know that the corporations know they can't profit from it greatly, so they haven't gone into the kind of research that would be necessary there. By the same token, when public research or public interest scientists develop something, this has actually happened in the past, a corporation will look at that development that happened with public money, change one gene, and patent it. So they then profit from that public research. The public interest scientists have gotten fairly sophisticated now. So, for instance, in the program that I wrote about, every time there's a development that's patentable, they patent it themselves. And that's simply so the corporations won't steal it. And then they turn around and give away the rights to it. There's some trading on that level, but the patenting problem is enormously complicated and enormously a sensitive issue now in developing world research.
Richard, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Richard Manning has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of the new book, Food's Frontier, The Next Green Revolution. The book is published by North Point Press, which is a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He is also the author of Last Stand, A Good House, Grassland, and One Round River.